these violent delights and violent ends.
Welcome to Violent Delights, a Westworld podcast. We are your hosts, Andrew Sorsini
and Dwayne D.
Tonight, we'll be talking about HBO's latest official trailer for Westworld Season 2. Total spoilers ahead, but hey, we don't have to tell you that by now. So let's just dive right into the after talk. Well, the pre-talk, pre-season talk. But before we do that, we have some online spots where you can get in contact with us. You can write to us or email us a voice memo at hbowestworldpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at hbowestworldpod. Or just hashtag Violent Delights. And our Facebook page is Westworld Podcast. You can add us on iTunes, like us, and please leave us a review. That's how we get noticed for our show. All right, let's get into it. So first thing we're going to do is talk about the official trailer for Westworld Season 2. And then we're going to, after we talk about that, we're going to talk about, I went to South by Southwest and I saw the Westworld showrunners and stars on a panel, and I also went to HBO Westworld's Live Without Limits experience where they recreated Sweetwater, and I'll talk about that as well.
Right, so this trailer came out on 29th of March 2018. We're recording this on April 1st, Easter. Yay.
Yeah.
So it's only a couple days old. It's already gotten 6.4 million views, and it's gotten multiple kind of reaction videos where people are trying to pull out Easter eggs and things like that. We're going to go through.
Right. And we'll go through. We're going to go through shot by shot breakdown. What we're going to do, like we did with the Super Bowl ad that they released, is we are going to we've seen this several times, but we're going to go through, watch the video, stop it scene by scene, and sort of break down every shot for you.
Right. So if you guys want to hop over to your YouTube and put it on mute, Andy and I will go through it. Also, there's music here, and that music is a cover of Nirvana's Heart-Shaped Box by Raymond Djawadi, who's a series composer. I think he's also the composer on Game of Thrones.
Yes, he is.
And so, Andy, you love this version of the song. We won't get into it, but we'll have to talk about how that plays into what we're seeing here once the reel is over.
Yes. Absolutely. So let's get into that. So first of all, the first thing we see is a shot of Bernard face down in the sand, and you see a overhead shot of the side of his arm and his glasses as well, and you hear him do a voiceover, and his voiceover says, "I dreamt I was on an ocean," and then you see the shore, wave come and wash his glasses and wash into him on the shore.
Right, it's almost as if his eyes are unclouded, right? Like his the things he uses to see are washed over.
Right.
And he's going to have a different reality here, perception.
When you cut to the shot of him on his side and the shore hitting him, there is a champagne glass next to him. So I'm assuming that this immediately follows the gala where Robert Ford unveiled his new narrative, and we saw the massacre of the hosts in the 10th episode of season 1.
Right, the massacre of the
host massacre of the of Robert Ford's guests, the VIP guests. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Although once again, everything we're saying here is supposition. There's no hard evidence, but we can make assumptions.
Based on the evidence put in front of us, yeah. Right? Like, yeah.
So we cut.
What's next?
We cut to a shot of Bernard standing at the shore, and you see he says, "And others were in the distant shore," and you see him standing at the shore. It's a shore of a it's a seashore. We're not entirely sure if it's an island or not. All we see is water and cliff sides, and there are bodies scattered throughout the ocean, and some of them washing up on shore.
The bay is littered with bodies. Some are floating, some are beached. It's pretty gnarly.
Yeah, not entirely sure what's going on here. There's a guy walking up to him, and then you hear...
in a suit.
Yeah, in a suit, and I think we see him in a scene a little bit later. We'll get to that in a second, because he appears to be a new character. And then you hear Dolores's voice, and she says, "Were you with us?" And then you get a close up, an extreme close up of Bernard.
In different glasses, by the way.
In different glasses. So I'm not entirely sure this could be Bernard or this could be Arnold in a flashback, because it's the same room that we've seen Arnold interrogate Dolores in the flashbacks throughout season one.
Right.
And he says no. And then you hear the music, and the music starts to play the Ramin Djawadi's cover of Nirvana's Heart-Shaped Box. Dolores says, what does it mean? And over that, you see a, this is a really interesting shot here. It's a encampment on the shore by a security team. And
yeah, it's a field office. Basically, you've seen war games, you've seen war, like back in the day where they have tents up, and this is almost like, they've got some sort of like, digital representation of the space, and they've got military personnel, the armed personnel, basically taking control of the beach. We don't know if it's the same beach, but we assume it may be. Mm-hmm. They've got gunboats and everything on the water,
and
they're just standing there surveying the scene, the area.
They've set up what appears to be this sort of portable hologram generator
of the map. Very Star Wars.
Yeah, it is totally. And this is. Well, maybe we might circle around and talk about this again, but this is the very shot where people have discovered an Easter egg, which is on the side of one of these hologram transmitters, is markings that look like a barcode, and it's actually binary code that translates to a website, a hidden website. So we'll circle around to that in a second, though. Let's carry on. So Dolores says, what does it mean? And then we see Bernard walking on the shore on this military encampment on the mainland, and or on the where
on the beach.
On the beach. Yep. We can't make any more assumptions other than that. And Bernard,
he doesn't have his glasses on, though. His glasses are lost, so his vision is no longer occluded by them.
Ah, that could be that's a very sort of double meaning there. And Bernard says, dreams don't mean anything, Dolores. And then we cut to a shot of Bernard slash Arnold in that lab that we've seen from the flashbacks when we knew it was Arnold speaking to Dolores. And Dolores has this sort of stunned look on her face as we see her in close-up. And Bernard says, that answer doesn't seem to satisfy you. And Dolores answers him with, because it's not completely honest. And I think that's a reference. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's so the idea that dreams don't mean anything is, you know, it might be scientifically accurate, but it's also one of those things where we as an audience, we simply don't know that to be true. Right. We still think about our dreams, what they mean to us, even if they don't mean anything clinically.
Yeah.
Dreams still influence the way we behave the next morning. Right.
Right.
I had a dream is the beginning of inspiration for millions of ideas. In addition to the fact that I had a dream is it can give you caution about something. Right. Like I had this dream and this thing happened to me. And now you're aware that this could happen to you, that kind of thing. So she's being right when she says that's not completely honest. She's being truthful. But what's also interesting is that Bernard is also being truthful from possibly like a clinical clinical standpoint. So to me, that's great because they're both speaking truth, but that truth is in conflict with one another. And given what we know of Dolores, that how she responds to untruth is never good. So it was to me, that was pretty interesting.
Right. Well, and I've seen other interpretations on it in reference to things that we've heard on the show about dreams from season one, where Dolores has said before, dreams are the mind telling stories to itself. And Ford has said, dreams mean everything. They are the stories we tell ourselves of what could be, who we could become. So it could be that when Bernard says dreams don't mean anything, Dolores is sort of calling back to Ford telling her quite the opposite, that dreams mean right. everything.
And let's not forget that Dolores is very much a representation, or Bilda's representation, of Alice in Wonderland. And
right.
Alice in Wonderland is told to us as a dream in many respects, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it never really happened. It was a dream. You know, she's just a spoiled brat who got in some trouble, and she dreamt the whole thing. Whether that was real or not, it changed Alice's experience of life. So, you know, there's that too. There's the idea that, like, Dolores as Alice, dreams are heavily impactful.
Sure.
But then the people around Alice, like, whatever, Alice, it's just a dream.
Right? I love all of the Alice in Wonderland references throughout season one. I just hope we see more of that in season two as well.
It would be nice to continue that as a theme. I think Alice in Wonderland has been used in many a thing.
Sure.
But here, I think this representation, and, you know, even The Matrix back in 99, that's where it's been done best. That's right. Where the reference to Lewis Carroll's work has been done best.
So then moving on, we see a shot of basically Westworld, the sort of the field with the canyon behind it.
The tepui, the large flat mesa, and mm-hmm. the step-like shrub grass with Dolores on horseback, armed.
Yeah, she's got a bandolier. And then we cut to a shot of her inside this modern library, and it could be a library.
With her same bandolier on, her same old style.
You're
clothes.
Right. Yeah. I just noticed that right now. So wherever she was writing to, she ended up in this fairly modern looking library.
That, or she was in that library, and we see her out of time, writing away from it with whatever knowledge she may have earned.
It's like a two-story library, and she's looking through the books.
You know what I think about when I see this? I think about the original Beauty and Beast and Belle in the Beast library.
Oh, interesting.
Right, like this, uh-huh. this kind of darling European-looking female right. in this place that's just full of books, and her face is, you know, covered in wonder as she looks at the knowledge that is possessed in these tomes.
Either way, I do see it as her gaining more knowledge. Like, this is like a representation, just a simple representation of her accumulating more knowledge about herself and about the world around her.
And we know it's somewhat forbidden, right? Because she isn't supposed to be in this modern space, right? Right. Dolores is a character that's supposed to be tied to the Old West, and this is modern space. Moreover, though, you know, she's in the bandolier, she's in the dress, but at the same time, you see the camera pan over bottles of whiskey and spirits,
yeah.
right? And it's all very laid out starkly in this kind of 21st century Gattaca, highly masculine mid-century modern kind of look. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like she's a person out of place. She's out of place as a Old West person in the modern times.
Yeah.
And she's also out of place as a woman in a man's world, because men have invented Westworld, and they've invented Westworld. And part of that is that she's made to suffer in their invention. But yeah. this is clearly a man's space, and she shouldn't be in here if they had their way.
We may be seeing more of that out of place motif later on in this trailer here as we go yeah. through. So then we get an out of focus Dolores coming into focus, and then you hear a voiceover where she says she said, "Did you ever stop and wonder about your actions?" And then she continues to say, the price that you'd have to pay if there was a reckoning. And then you cut to a shot of her talking to a man in nice suit who is on his knees and possibly,
in the wild, yeah,
in the wild, and possibly tied up, has his hands tied in front of him. And you see,
he's at her mercy.
Yes.
She's got a weapon in front of him and everything. And you know, I do think about, I mean, I don't know when this was written and filmed.
Yeah.
But the price you'd have to pay if there was a reckoning, as this woman speaks to this man who was once in power, clearly from his his attire and everything. I can't help but say it kind of reminds me of what's been going on the last several months in the wake of Harvey Weinstein.
It's very prescient.
We call the Me Too moment the reckoning, right? We call that the reckoning, and it's about women taking down men who are once powerful because of their actions. Did you ever stop to think about your actions?
It does make me wonder if that prescience is a reflection of when it was filmed, or if all this just sort of coincidentally came as this stuff was happening in real life.
Yes, I don't want to go ahead and say that this was a direct response to the Me Too Reckoning situation, but I will say that I wouldn't be surprised if it was. You can pull actors back in. You can reshoot and re-record to make your stuff more relevant to the day.
Sure.
You can do all of that.
But it also thematically reflects the plight of the hosts from the beginning. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And we see on the periphery of this shot, we see a couple of other nicely dressed people in suits and nice dresses standing on top of crosses that are at grave sites. And my guess is that they are probably being hung. Like they are probably
hanging by the neck until death.
Hanging by the neck, and they're standing on these crosses to prevent them from being completely hanged, but that they're at the mercy of Dolores, and it looks like Teddy is on horseback behind her. Oh, and in fact, in the following shot, You do see, in fact, that they are hanging from a tree. So yeah,
there are multiple bodies being hanged as they walk away. Whether the fate of those bodies, are they just balancing on crosses, or have they been totally and utterly killed? We don't know.
And right? Judging by the dress, I would have to assume that those are VIPs from the gala, which would be the Delos board.
Right. They're people in modern dress for sure. Right. So that's something to think about. They're not people in the Old West style. I mean, and what's great is that in that original shot you mentioned where Dolores is kneeling in front of the man, when you see Teddy in the background, Teddy's a relatively well-dressed guy for his time.
Yeah.
So it contrasts starkly with the guy in the suit jacket that Dolores is talking to, and the style of sort of like dress of the people who are standing on those crosses. So.
Yep. Next we have a shot of Tallulah Riley as Angela, and she is wearing what appears to be a crown of thorns, and
it looks like a bandana that's a little soaked in blood. Maybe she
could
was in a situation where she was bleeding. But the crown of thorns, the frizzled hair, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely like a, you know, it's Easter. There's a theme.
Yeah. And she's brandishing a gun and pointing at somebody, and you hear Dolores continue to say that reckoning is here, and then you see the gunshot as Angela fires at something off screen. We don't see what it is, but she definitely looks like she's out for revenge, and she's out for
And that line as she pulls the trigger, that line comes, she pulls the trigger, and then we're immediately again sitting in a place where we have the other strong female of the hosts, Dani Newton, who plays Maeve, standing inside, right?
Yeah, so Maeve is in the map room with Lee Sizemore. And they are the two like living people who are standing,
the last one standing.
amongst a field of murdered,
five dead people. Yeah.
Yes, and in this map room, and we're not sure.
And like, it's not just that they're dead; they've been mercilessly killed.
Yes, there's shot.
Blood on the ground
for sure.
They've been taken out, and some of those people are in host attire, and some of those people are in modern attire.
Oh, interesting.
But there was some sort of battle going on here. And Maeve and Sizemore are both the only ones standing. So there's a reckoning, a shot.
Right.
And then these bodies were shot. And it represents what's going on in the park, which is wild and outdoors. And then inside the inner workings of Westworld, which is supposed to be tame.
Right.
But both places are in a state of disarray.
Yep. And then we see a shot of a group of people, and it looks like
contemporary modern people.
Yes, it looks like a security detail. It looks like a security team, and they're walking. It's an overhead shot as we see them walking through a gravesite, walking towards a group of people who are dead on the ground from being massacred.
This is a tactical oversight. So you see this clearly, I mean, it's been set up so that you see clearly there's a person or two that are more civilian in charge, sure, wearing business suit type attire, maybe security business suit type attire, but they're surrounded by people on tactical gear,
yep,
protected. And there's a radius around them of people with automatic weapons. So if the host should come out with a weapon, it's not going to be, you know, an old school, old style weapon. It's not going to be as effective as what these guys are. So these contemporary Westworld people, Westworld, you know, runners, the people who run the park,
right, security detail, right?
Yeah, they're scared, right? They wouldn't normally, you see them just walking around, and being ignored by a host. But in this case, because they are walking through this grave field and then into the town center where all these bodies are on the ground, yeah, they are on alert. They're not just, yeah, they know that they're not in control of their domain. Anything could happen, so I'm going to unabashedly have a security detail around me.
Yeah, so they're walking into Escalante now, where the gala was, the VIP gala was for the Delos board, and it's just a field of littered bodies. And in the center of this shot is a man we've never seen before. So new guy, season two.
Man with the beard.
Yeah, and he appears to be the leader of the security detail. And then we see, yeah, a side shot of him walking through the town as well. Bald man with a beard.
And Bernard is with him.
Bernard is with him as well. And over this, you hear the man in black say, "Up until this point, the stakes were never real, but now you and the rest of your kind are free." And then we cut to...
Right. And just before we leave that, remembering that the man in black is William.
Right.
And also that in all of season one, when we saw the man in black, he was looking for a reality check. He was looking for true adventure, a game that was difficult for him to win. He was looking to up the stakes. And so what we're seeing when he says that is that the stakes have been upped. This is the price of upping the stakes. This is what it takes to make those stakes more dangerous and more real, to give him the acceleration he needed, right? The, yeah, the quickening of his pace. He just felt like everything was too easy. He'd done it all before. But now that he has to actually like fight for his life and deal with the fact that these things are real, we're not sure whether he's reveling in it, whether he regrets it, but he recognizes it, and that, I think, is significant.
For sure. And we cut to another shot. It's it appears to be Sweetwater at a different time, and Angela – oh, no, it's Dolores with the bandolier. She's riding through. We're not entirely sure what's going on, but it's a very brief shot. And yep, we cut to a close-up of the man in black as he
– There are still dead people there, though, right?
Yes.
There's a person literally over a barrel. There are some bodies littered across the street. So we don't know when this is, but it appears to be the same time that we see Dolores hanging these people and Dolores in the library and so on. So there's a chronological theme, it seems, going on to, yeah, her story during this this thing. And even in that shot, it's broken glass, and that glass is covered with blood, whether it's host blood or human blood, we don't know.
Yeah.
And there's a face. The face of death, and she's walking into the face of death, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's represented by the face of death. So she's a badass. I mean, we know she killed Ford, or she killed something that looked like Ford, and now she's death and destruction everywhere she goes.
Yep. We see the man in black, who is old William, as we know.
Ed Harris.
Ed Harris. He's finishing up his sentence there, and we cut to a shot of Maeve. And she appears to be over her daughter from her previous existence, her pre-madam existence.
Giving her a kiss on her forehead as she lays the child down to sleep.
So yes.
This is a very tender scene. This isn't the Maeve that we're used to in terms of her kind of cutthroat focus on either business or revenge, because that's kind of how we've seen Maeve the entire time. And we hear Lee Sizemore say she's something we programmed, right?
Right.
Immediately after, we see a picture of the modern Maeve, and that leads me to believe that Maeve is remembering her daughter. She's like, yep, where is she?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Sizemore is like, oh, we programmed her.
Yeah.
She may have never even existed.
She's not
she
real.
She might have just been software. She's not real.
Right. And then we cut to Maeve basically grabbing Sizemore and pushing him up against the wall and demanding, she says, "You're going to take me to my daughter."
She doesn't, if his statement, whether it's true or not, it's not a statement that she believes, right?
Yeah.
So it may have been that the daughter was all software, a memory implanted in her head in order to get her to do whatever role she had before. Or it may be that Sizemore is like, I don't know. I don't know where she is, so I'm just going to say she's not real.
I want to address that for just a second here, because I just rewatched season one again. And towards the end of season one, they talk about discovering that all of Maeve's motivations of enticing hosts to recruiting hosts and enticing them to help her escape the park, that was all part of a deeper core reprogramming. We're not entirely sure by whom, but we're presuming it's by Robert Ford. Right. So when she in episode 10 in the last season, when she is on board the train ready to go to the outside world, she takes a look again at the note that Felix left her of where her daughter is, and then she makes the decision to get off the train and abandon that reprogramming. Quest. That is her taking. That is her.
Taking initiative. Possibly.
Taking initiative. Having.
She's either possibly leaving her programming, or exactly an authentic Maeve.
That's,
or she's being manipulated. We don't know. But I do feel like we're being kind of pushed into the idea that the Maeve we will see when she gets off that train is an authentic, unbridled, uncontrolled, unmanipulated Maeve.
Yep.
But the nature of the show
leaves
me somewhat skeptical. Right.
Sure. But I'm going to go with the idea that they're not doubling back on a double back.
I wouldn't put it past Nolan and Joy.
Sure. And then we cut to a shot of one of the technician rooms and the analyzing rooms, and
in basically the Westworld upside down. So in the tech center, and there is a woman. A female host, it seems, naked as a jaybird, sitting down on a stool.
Yes, and we cut to the reverse shot, and it is Dolores. And it's Dolores, and we see the camera pulls away, the opposite angle is young William.
Young man in black in modern dress.
I don't entirely understand this shot. It doesn't make any sense to me, but I'm sure that it will be explained when we get into season two. Because this to me makes no sense based on what we've seen from season one. So this is like really.
Right. Although I look at it, and the evidence I see here is that if we're post season one, there is a time when young William becomes the man in black, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that it has to happen when he's like 60 or 70, as Ed Harris is. It could have happened when he was in his early 40s, late 30s, where young William is, where this actor is playing young William. So him having been on the board, whatever, getting on the board, we see him here basically interrogating her with the kind of indomitable attitude that we've noticed from the man in black.
Yeah.
So to me, it seems like a shot that bridges the two, the missing link, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm excited about this, seeing this scene in the body of the series when we see it. All right, when we cut to a overhead shot of a canyon, and Dolores says, "Here we are." There's a rider on a horse. We're not entirely sure who that is. Dolores says, "Here we are, a kind that will never know death." And then we cut to a reverse angle of that rider, perhaps that rider. It could be another rider. But in the foreground is...
He's moving away in the background, moving away from the shot in the background. But in the foreground is who, Andy?
It's Robo Ford Jr.
Yeah, it's young Ford. It's the host version of young Ford, and he is not in good shape. What do you say?
Yeah, his face is cracked open. His front face is cracked open.
One of his lips is gone. His nose is no longer there.
Yeah.
And he's not moving. And it's if these hosts are a previous version, this is a version that is before sort of the bioelectronics, right? So he's not bleeding or anything. He simply looks like a broken doll.
Right, exactly.
And there's a man on horseback, it seems, riding away as if to suggest that he is the reason why he's a broken doll. Unless he came up, he could have come across him.
Yeah.
And that's just an establishment shot of what's going on in the park. Or he could have been taken part in the destruction of that guy.
So Dolores says, here we are, a kind that will never know death, and yet we are fighting to live. And then we get some rapid shots here. There is a shot of a...
a dune buggy, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
With like heavily armed men holding on to the dune buggy while men are inside the dune buggy. The man in the dune buggy, as well as the two, one of the men in the passenger seat and the two men who are holding on the side, kind of like garbage men,
holding on
to the side of the truck. They are holding submachine guns, carbines.
Yep.
They are flanked by people on foot.
Yep.
And they are letting fly a series of rounds toward an unknown adversary enemy.
Yep, we don't know who they're shooting at, but they're definitely shooting at somebody. And then we get a shot of a number of Confederate Army soldiers barricading a door at a fortress.
When I look at that,
mm-hmm.
they don't seem to me to be barricading the door. They seem to me to be trying to get past a gate.
Maybe so.
There are many people by the door, but then if you look closer toward the camera, a man on the far left, he's got his gun cocked and he's looking at something that is where our eye, he's looking toward us, right? So there's something coming at him.
So maybe they're trying to get out.
Right. And there's a man to the left, not quite all the way over, who's got his rifle also pointed at us, the viewer. So it's as if the people who are at the gate are like, hey, let us in. And these guys are trying to stave off something. And it may very well be that they're trying to stave off these modern security forces equipped with stronger firepower that are there to, like, shut them down, take them out. And they're running for their lives.
Right. That's what it appears like. So she says, and yet here we are fighting to live. We get a close-up shot of Dolores caressing...
the beard of Bernard,
yes.
or Arnold. We're not sure which
one.
She is being incredibly intimate with him, which is an interesting thing because typically we have seen them, if this is Arnold, we've seen them in intimate situations, but they're verbally intimate. There's not a physical intimacy involved, right? In fact, Arnold is chided for not talking to Dolores, for talking to Dolores while she's wearing clothing, right? He's not interested in being in a place where he has fundamental superior power over her. And so while he knows he's like intellectually more powerful because she's just a host and she's in her early stages, there is no kind of physical intimacy there. There is an emotional intimacy in that he treats her kind of like a daughter. He gives her the Alice paradigm. He wants to get more out of her. But in this shot, she's stroking his chin and he looking somewhat unsettled or angry about that. It's almost as if she's there
comforting him, maybe
calm him down, comfort him. Exactly. And it's a role reversal in that normally, you know, Bernard is in charge or Arnold is in charge. And here she's basically appealing to him with, frankly, a very feminine and intimate gesture that we're not used to seeing her initiate. You know, usually someone's initiating it toward her, but they have a very close and complicated relationship. And so this is a very interesting shot.
What she's saying, there is beauty in what we are. Now, is she referring to when she says we, is she referring to her known group of people, hosts, or is she including Bernard in that group? As far as
right, so if she's aware, and I think she may be aware, because when you look at the shot where it reverses, so you can see her face and her hand touching Bernard, she looks like she's wearing the tank top and the bandolier. So this would be, from my perspective, an aware Dolores.
Yeah,
understanding that this is not Arnold, but this is Bernard, and she is letting him know that it's okay to be what they are.
Yeah,
realizing that. Bernard, again, has just come to understand what he is, that he's not in fact a human, but that he is in fact a host. And so in this moment, she is being the leader to him that Arnold was to her.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the day. So that's kind of what I'm taking from that. You know, this is a 2-minute, 40-second thing. We're halfway through, guys. But I think we're making good progress.
Yes. So it'll get fast and furious from here. Because the rapid shots, we get a shot of modern Maeve in modern dress attending to Hector Eschaton in an operating table, and he's shirtless
in the upside down in the in the tech area of Westworld. He's shirtless in a robe. It looks like maybe there was some blood on the whatever coverings he's wearing, and of course there are dead tech. There's a dead tech just lying on the ground. There may be two of them. I can't really quite tell. But Maeve is who has manipulated Hector Eschaton before, I believe. She is standing there in her modern clothing, mm-hmm. Attending to him in some way, appealing to him in some way.
Yep. And we get a shot of the of Westworld, the mesas in the prairie, and we hear Teddy Flood's voice, and he says, "We've ridden 10 miles." And then we see Teddy and Dolores, and he continues, "And all we've seen is blood. Is this really what you want?" he says to her.
And right. She's saying this to, again, Bandelier Dolores.
Yes.
Which, aware Dolores.
Right. That's what we're presuming, is this is post VIP gala massacre Dolores.
Mm-hmm. So, and basically that assumption is correct, it totally makes sense. So he's like, "We've ridden 10 miles and all we've seen is blood. Is that what you want?" If she, in fact, is the cause of these body exchanges, Teddy, who hasn't been awoken, who isn't aware.
Yeah.
He recognizes that he's drawn to her, tied to her, obeying her, but he's still in character. And he's like, "This is really what you want." This is interesting.
It's like he's saying, "Is this what you want your legacy to be?"
Right.
And
just like anybody else, I mean, Teddy may be a host, but the character he's playing is human.
Right.
And he's like, a normal, regular person would be like, "Is this, the idea of blood, destruction, death, is that what you really, you want to see?" And so that's, it's an interesting reversal.
Yep. And then we cut to a shot. This is an interesting shot. It is a flickering hallway with the door. Like, we've seen the door that transitions from the
what door?
the door that transitions from, and we saw this in season 1, episode 2, I believe. The door that transitions from the orientation room where you're able to choose your hat and get
costume
and gear up.
A regular person costumes up to become a part of Westworld.
Yeah, and it's the door that leads into the train car that will eventually take you to the park. It's sort of an antique style door, and we see Bernard coming through that door, which, again, I think that shot sort of represents is a major motif of this season 1 was subtitled The Maze for the whole season. Season 2's subtitle for the whole season is The Door. So we're going to see repetition of this motif over and over again.
I think. Especially with that. I mean, to go back to that what door reference more seriously, the idea of Bernard walking through a door, mm-hmm. when a door he didn't notice was what he had to walk through to know what he was.
Exactly.
Just speaks to that awareness again. And I mean, flickering, right? You can't really see what's going on when things are flickering. You don't really have a complete perception of everything that's going on. But when things are flickering, it's usually a sign that something's wrong. The lights aren't working, that kind of thing. Flickers are a pretty modern thing. There was no flickering. I mean, aside from fires, right? There was no flickering, wholesale flickering, until we electrified our right. lifestyle back in like the early 20th century. So it's this kind of like, again, a new phenomenon. He's experiencing a new phenomenon. So yeah. I feel like that's a thing. It's ominous. And that's followed by it cuts to a very ominous shot. Andy, what shot is that?
So we see a close up of Bernard inside the map room, but behind him we can see in sort of blurred figures, and these blurred figures
chaos.
are in chaos. So we're not sure. There's some sort of chaos going on, perhaps a massacre, definitely a conflict.
Then it cuts again, right? It cuts to, we see our friend Dolores. She is walking in a bandolier, tank top on. She's got a whole bunch of Old West people with her, but they're in the Upside Down, you know, in this in this technified area. And there's a quote she's saying as she walks with her, what seems to be her army. And what's she saying?
She says, "It's us or them." And we see this sort of smoked out technician area. So this is, I think this is post-conflict as she's walking through here. And then we cut to a shot of sort of a sandy area, and there is one of of the park, and we see one of the Ghost Nation warriors riding up on a horse, and then we cut to a close up of his face, which is half black and half white paint, right.
Just like his horse too. So his horse is half black and half white, that he's riding on. When we see the back shot. And then it does cut to his face, where it's black from his forehead all the way down to the tip of his nose, and then it's a crusted over white. But beneath that, there's something else on his face, Andy. What color is that? What are we seeing there?
We're seeing trying to roll back to see what you're seeing, because so we see red. We see red lines, painted lines. Part of his facial decoration, so
almost like blood.
Yes,
almost like a bloody hand.
Certainly,
clasped him under his chin and let go and left that blood there.
Certainly. So, there may be some. It may be decoration, or maybe a sign of conflict. Looks more like decoration to me, to be honest. But we'll see.
It does seem like a sort of aggressive possible war paint.
Yeah.
Thing. I'm not familiar with the way paint is used in native tribes, but he is armed. He's got a quiver of arrows. He's got a recurve bow. He's ready for action, as ready as anyone would ever be. It's one of those things where his conflict, and he's coming across something. He's in the desert.
Yeah.
He's coming across this, it's a wasteland, and on that wasteland is a stump of a tree, what's left of a tree, and slumped on the stump is a person. Looks like a male.
It looks like a male who is naked.
Yeah.
What was the last... in season one, when was the last time that we saw a naked male person out in the middle of the park?
William's cousin or brother or whatever?
It was William's brother sent him on the horse. Off to the edge of the park.
Right. It's almost like he hasn't been there very long, because the footprints that got him there are still there.
Yep.
Someone's coming across that guy. And then it just kind of like cuts to this beautiful shot, helicopter kind of, or crane or something, going across the park, over a canyon, looking at lakes.
Yeah,
With a sunset or sunrise, and with all that beauty in nature, it moves directly into a shot of modern day people in a canyon, contemporary to Westworld's time. And just as Maeve says, revenge is just a different prayer. We see Tessa Thompson's character in body armor.
Yep,
riding
in this river in the middle of this canyon.
Exactly, with some support around her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, tactical people, the glasses, the technology, in stark contrast to this beautiful natural scene. That's what we're seeing. And then
Maeve says, "Revenge is just a different prayer at their altar, darling." And as we see,
this is a confrontation between Maeve and Dolores here.
Yep. Yep, we see.
And we know it's a confrontation because Teddy has his gun out pointed at me.
Mm-hmm.
And
Maeve is in modern dress, and Dolores is in her frontier dress with the bandolier. So we can presume that this is immediately after the VIP gala massacre.
Fire and brimstone all around. So buildings are burning. You know, fire is there.
So
we're seeing a profile of these two women.
And
it's interesting because they are the two women at either side of this conflict, right?
Right.
They're actually, in many ways, they're on the same side. But we haven't really seen them interact. There's rarely a time in the first season where Maeve and Dolores are interacting. So it's entirely possible that they don't recognize one another. At least Dolores doesn't recognize Maeve.
We did see her in at least in one episode have an interaction.
Right, I'm saying it's rare.
Sure.
So it's entirely possible that Dolores can see Maeve dressed in the modern clothing attire of Dolores's enemies, and also because Teddy doesn't quite recognize her, to pull the gun on her for them to come across as hostile.
If Maeve is telling Dolores that revenge is just a different prayer at their altar, what that says is that she's trying to convince Dolores that what she's doing is not a solution to the larger problem, that she is just sort of playing into the hand of the hosts.
The people running the park. So because the idea of if revenge is a prayer, or just a different prayer at their altar, you're still praying at their altar.
Exactly.
Right? So that's it's a great catch. I love it.
We cut to a shot of Dolores firing within this conflict.
There's a conflict. There's you see a mortar go off.
Yeah,
she's got a gun raised. She's in this place, and she's clearly about to let out fire and fury.
Yeah, this could be that same fortress that we saw the Confederates trying to get out of.
Or get into
earlier.
The gate that's behind her does look very familiar.
We cut to an overhead shot of a circle of figures collapsing, and in the center of that circle of figures are two other figures. Not entirely sure who those two other figures are. Maybe it's Teddy and Dolores. Could be. It's difficult to say at this point, but they're collapsing in unison around these figures. Who knows what that means?
A nice deus ex machina for whoever's in the center of that circle.
Yep.
The ability for all of the people encircling them to fall down and they be left standing. And then it shoots to, all that is very, it's obscured. Those last few shots are very obscured. There's smoke, there's whatever.
Yeah.
And then we get a clear face-on shot of Thandie Newton's Maeve in the park, in a shawl. Yep.
In a shawl. And
not in the modern dress that we've seen her in throughout most of this trailer. She is got a look on her face of almost complete wonder, questioning, what am I looking at? And she's got Escalante at her side with his shotgun, or his rifle rather, raised at whatever it is that they're both seeing together. So it's unclear whether she's, we saw her in the beginning of the trailer in the Upside Down, in the technological place. So we saw her working with Escalante, whether it's cooing him, bidding him to come out to help her. Then we see her in front of, Dolores in the park, and now we're seeing her again in the park, with Escalante as at her side. So this transition of Maeve back into the park, but on her own terms, seems to be the progression of her character through the season. Through the trailer, if not through the season.
Yep. We see a side shot of her running through this conflict where you see hosts, appears to be hosts attacking other hosts, or at least people in hosts in frontier dress there's attacking.
And there's some sort of chaos where everyone's running in the opposite direction she's running into.
Yeah.
Right. So there's something that they're trying to get away from, and there's something that she's running toward, which is interesting.
Yeah. And then we get an interesting shot, interesting because it's sort of new to the whole, show, is that we see the shot of Logan, Ben Barnes' character, William's brother-in-law, and he is on a poolside deck and walking toward...
An infinity pool,
overlooking an ocean. Yep, and walking towards the camera is a character that we have been introduced to on the websites as James Delos, who is the founder of Delos.
Right. And his relationship with Logan, we're not super sure.
I think he
could be Logan's father. He's definitely old enough to be. But at the same time, we know that Logan was involved in the company in some way. We know there's a board, and in many cases, boards don't get along with... don't get along with founders. You know, it is Ford's park and design, but it's still called Dulles Corporation. Yep. The organization relationships are not laid out, but there does seem to be something quite dramatic here. It almost seems as if Logan is calling out to this man who's now walking away from them, both of them dressed in black, which seems to be the thing about being a dude in this part of the 21st century.
So, but we're not sure entirely. This could either be after the whole aftermath with Logan and William in the past, in the flashbacks, yep, or this could be before, even before all of that has occurred. We're not entirely sure. And then we cut to a close-up of in the dark of two characters kissing. Not entirely sure who those characters are. And then we cut to a shot of what appears to be...
Well, I mean, we definitely see that flaxen hair.
You think it could be Dolores?
I wouldn't be surprised if it were Dolores, but I think you're right not to try to tie anything. We haven't seen... I kind of feel like it's not worth putting a random character kissing.
Yeah.
Unless you wanted to lead people astray. But we simply don't know what male she's with, whoever this person is. But it is surprising to me to see the flaxen hair of Dolores, you know, Evan Rachel Wood's wig over there. So,
as an editor, I can say from experience, when you get to these trailers, when you're cutting these trailers and you get to the climax of these trailers, it is a lot of really quick random shots that may not necessarily make sense in context, but may just look good.
And make a narrative for the particular trailer itself.
Right, right. Mm. So we're in that territory now where a lot of these shots are going to be super quick. And
three quarters of the way through, yep, we're at the climax.
So we have a shot of a modern-looking, very fancy, what looks like hallway.
Hotel. I mean, it looks like almost like the White House or a palace or something, mm-hmm, like that. It's very fancy, you know, carpet with all this stuff on it. Somebody walking. It's a
down shot.
The camera pans up as this person is walking,
and it looks like it could be Man in Black.
It could be old Mr. Dulles, or it could be the Man in Black. From the gate, it feels to me like it could be the Man in Black.
Yep.
But they just don't want you to know.
And we get a VO of a voiceover of the Man in Black, and he says, "They want a new place hidden from God." And as we see that, we see a shot of Clementine, but behind her are these modern
Dune buggies
is security detail. So
she looks cracked out. She's not in a good way. You know, her eyes are puffy. It almost looks like she has almost black eyes.
Looks a little zoned out. So we're not entirely sure what's going on there, but she seems to be emotionless.
Well, it's more than that. So to look at her, there are incisions across her neck and shoulder, almost like she was a cadaver.
Yes. Well, as we know, the last time that we saw Clementine, she had been lobotomized and was in the cold storage.
Right. So she had been lobotomized in cold storage. So she looks as whack as one would when it happened. So for the Man in Black to say they want a new place hidden from God and to see somebody that was, you know, structurally abused by this system, and that is now flanked, and it looks like it's being supported by the same security forces we've seen throughout the trailer, is a very interesting juxtaposition.
Yep. We cut to what looks like a reverse shot of that same scenario while we have the security detail of dune buggies riding over a pretty flat prairie. And then we cut to, this is interesting. This is where it also starts to get really interesting.
This is where the wheels fall off the bus, man.
Oh, yeah? You think so?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a moment where you're seeing familiar characters, you're seeing them in strange places, you know, juxtaposed with what you might expect from them given season one or whatever. And then, I mean, this situation you're talking about right here, where it gets, it's where the wheels fall off the bus. We're back in the Upside Down.
Yeah, we're back in the technician's area.
And we begin to see, you know, in the original title sequence for Westworld, you'll see them putting together bodies with this sort of like muscular string 3D printing process. But now we're seeing those preformed beings, no face, no external flesh, no nipples, no
whatever. I do
want
to say that that these particular proto-hosts were are a different type that we've been introduced to over interviews and discussions regarding season two. These are known as drone hosts. So this is a different class of hosts.
Of hosts, what like Dolores and the old man, Bill or Bob. This is a different class of hosts, but they are completely and utterly alien.
Right. And we're not entirely sure what their purpose are. If I had to guess, I'd say they have a even the name alone, drone hosts, suggests that maybe they have a militaristic utilization. Like this could be a different use of the hosts for military application.
Right. We do see, at first we see some people in lab coats walking through this space in the Upside Down next to one of these 3D printing things. It's using the sort of like string like material to put somebody together. And these hosts are there. And then we quickly see one of these hosts knocking one of these lab clad in people down into what seems to be a vat of water. And it doesn't look like that person wants to.
It's a vat of sort of the milky solution that these hosts
creates them.
Yeah.
So we're not sure whether that person in the lab coat was a rogue host that was being thrown down there, or if that's just one of these drone hosts himself or itself, because this doesn't really have genitalia, although it's a masculine form, going rogue. So this host might be going rogue.
Right.
And we had some. What is the Man in Black's full sentence?
So continuing on, he says they want a new place hidden from God. We had something else in mind entirely. I'm going to burn this whole thing to the ground, is what he says. That's his whole sentence there. And continuing on from what we last saw with the drone host knocking
Smackdown drone.
smacking this apparently this technician into this forming fluid, we see a close-up shot. This is really interesting. A close-up shot of a part being constructed at the micro level, sort of this micro
it's like an organ, an essential piece of whatever it is.
Some sort of red colored
heart, it could be the brain,
circular organ. If I had to guess, again, pure speculation, but this is part of where we're listening to this is to speculate. I would say that this is the brain of the hosts.
The brain, the mind, it's something that is at the heart of the cognition of these beings.
It's being stitched together, and then we see the man in black, or a figure in black, walk.
He's clad much like the man in black that we
And he's got the knife. So I think it is. I think
he's
it is
the knife. And he's so we're left to believe that it is him because of the way he's dressed and the knife he's holding.
Yeah,
but he's limping toward what looks to be like a bunker entrance. In a desert like area.
Yeah, and it's
cuts to his face.
It's a bunker image that is camouflaged, so it's something that is not. It seems to me like that's apart from the regular sort of Delos technician area. Like maybe it's like a black box area, a place that wasn't supposed to be noticed. Because it's got these sort of camouflage doors.
Right. This is an incognito type of place. But part of the reason why we think this is a man in black is because it then cuts directly to his face where he finishes his sentence, I'm going to burn this whole thing to the ground.
Yeah.
And so we look at that, and it's a narrative in and of itself.
Yep.
So where do we go next from here? Like, what do we see right after that?
So next we see him... In a Western setting, we're assuming Westworld, and somebody is grabbing him.
Hold me back.
It's in the dark. Somebody is grabbing him as he's brandishing a weapon and firing it towards, and we see the reverse angle, firing it towards somebody who seems to be firing at him in the rain, in the dark.
Exactly. Someone's trying to hold him back, you know, for whatever reason, and he is determined to pull that trigger at whoever it is. And then it actually cuts to this interesting space, which we have speculated about in the previous season of Violent Delights, which is effectively a person.
Hold on to your horses.
Japanese Shogun era battle armor.
Yep.
Surrounded by other men dressed in the same type of clothing with the flags, the kind of like banners of Japanese war, almost Japanese Game of Thrones is really what we're
seeing here. Japanese battle flags. So this is definitely a different
Imperial Japanese battle flags.
This is definitely a different environment than Westworld.
Right. It is old. And what I think is incredible is that it then cuts to an image of Maeve walking along this space during this kind of like battle chant. She's in a kimono.
Uh-huh.
Her hair is done in the traditions of feudal Japan.
Yep.
She's saying they're lost in the dark. And it is another juxtaposition for Maeve, right? So she is now, to put it bluntly, she is this black woman mm-hmm. in traditional Japanese dress who is walking astride and comfortable and out in the open in a culture that we historically knew as one that was not accepting of difference. They didn't let Europeans in. They certainly didn't let Africans in. They didn't let anybody in. And here she is saying they're lost in the dark. And that to me is a pretty powerful statement. It also makes me recall the man in black walking toward that bunker. There is reason to believe that that bunker is a gate away and out of Westworld, possibly into Shogun World. If you remember the Westworld film, you could move between the different parks in the resort. The original film in 1973, you could go from Westworld into medieval world into like Greco-Roman world. And it would be one of those back gate entrances that gets you from one to the other, because of course you're not supposed to really be able to do that. So, but Maeve, they're lost in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And then it moves again to like, is it new characters? I don't know.
Well, we get a quick shot, and I think that might be Logan on a bed, on a what appears to be a modern bed in a modern, well-appointed room.
Contemporary to the time that Westworld itself was built.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And he is surrounded by naked and half-naked men and women both, which we've seen Logan has a proclivity for both. So,
I mean, it's a lascivious situation.
Yeah. It's a super quick shot, and then we cut to a closer shot, and there is a person that turns towards the camera, and it appears to be Angela, if I'm not mistaken.
I can't really tell. But I will say that it's definitely somebody who's got agency in that room. They're making a decision to get up and put on their clothes, despite the fact that everybody else seems tranced out.
Yeah.
And that's a thing. We then move to a shot where, surprisingly, we see what looks to be the man in black, using his right hand to hold a six shooter to his head.
Yeah. I don't understand that, but.
And there's no, there's no dialogue right there or anything.
Who knows? Then we get a shot of Dolores and Teddy, and they appear to be in it's
some sort of argument, some sort of I don't agree with what's going on.
I'm not sure the setting, but there's some.
I mean, they're in Westworld. They're in the park.
They're in Westworld. There's some scaffolding.
This could be minutes after. After, hey, we've ridden 10 miles and seen nothing but blood, or it could be hours, but. Teddy is, you know, she regards Teddy, she's looking down at Teddy almost from where he is, and Teddy has a look of exasperation. I mean, body language is everything here, but it's an interesting dynamic between the two of them, because they have shown each other such affection in the past, and now these looks are less than happy.
Yeah. We get a shot of a woman. We see her in reverse, she's facing away from the camera in one of the technician rooms in Delos. And she is facing towards this mechanical contraption. I'm not entirely sure what it is. It's some sort of device.
But we have the voiceover from Dolores saying, I know exactly what is out there. And the woman that we're seeing from the back is the shape and blondness of Dolores.
I don't know about that.
Okay,
She looks a little thinner, and the hair looks a little different. But I will say that immediately following that shot is a shot of Dolores in what appears to be modern dress. Holy shit, modern dress in what appears to be a modern setting. She's got her hair pulled back.
There's a cityscape around her.
And she says, I know exactly what is out there, as we see her looking out over a modern city. Oof, this whole shot sort of blows me away as in anticipation of what this could mean for the show.
Right. So her hair is up in a bun, right? Because the idea of back length hair in the modern world is strange. Right? So right. The hair is up in a bun. She is wearing, Dolores tends to dress in Westworld somewhat conservatively, as people do. But this is a shot that's designed to sort of appeal to the sort of free and open sexual nature of the people we've seen in the contemporary setting of the people who've made Westworld. She's looking over at the cityscape. Her back is out, her shoulders are out, and she is unabashedly chosen to present herself as a sex object, which is or an object.
I mean, that's a lot of assumption for the shot. I'm not entirely sure.
I'm going to take back as a sex object, but as a person who is comfortable with their sex, as opposed to Dolores, who is in her time a person who is more prudish, right?
Sure.
Her moment when she got with William was a big step for her character. To willfully engage in sexual contact with somebody is a big step for her character. But if we go back to the earlier scene where she is caressing Bernard's beard, she's taking agency of her body. And then the apotheosis of that is her here in this cityscape and in this outfit, which is clearly sexualized in the way that HBO likes to do it, right? So I think that's what we're seeing in respects.
Next shot, we see Teddy in what appears to be a technician center in what appears to be modern black attire, brandishing clearly a modern automatic weapon.
Semi-automatic weapon.
Semi-automatic. Yeah. I'm sorry. Not automatic, but not a revolver.
The old west. Yes. Yeah. It's a Glock or some other semi-automatic. Clip-based pistol.
Yeah. So, and so he's brandishing that towards somebody else in the foreground. We're not entirely sure. Once again, these are all quick cuts, but we're breaking it down for you. We see a shot of Dolores in modern white attire sitting at a piano in a modern party atmosphere. It looks like it could be the same setting as we saw her before, looking out over the city, because I see some of the same sort of architecture elements involved.
It's in the modern space, but whereas her attire over the cityscape was
black.
Definitely, it was black, and it was night attire, evening attire, let's call it. She is in a more formal outfit here, sitting at a piano. And there are other women around her similarly dressed in white. Yeah.
And there's a man walking towards her. And I would guess that is young William, because it looks sort of like his profile from the back.
Perhaps, But so this setting is possibly related to the other setting. But given the size of the stones around and the piano and everything else, aside from her attire, it's entirely unclear. I think it's not quite. But they do use the same modern fashion look of the dress that has the shoulders out and the tapering of the bodice toward the mock turtleneck in order to lay this out. And again, she's not the only woman in a white dress here. It seems like this is a situation where these females are wearing white. I mean, that maybe could be Tallulah Riley over there. And the men are wearing typical suits. So we don't really know what's going on, but this is a very different scenario than what we're used to seeing these characters in. But then we move on.
Yep, we move on to, and this is a super creepy shot, Charlotte Hale, Tessa Thompson's character, and she is standing in what appears to be like a cold storage area with the security detail surrounding her, and she is in a room of what appears to be a number of abandoned Bernard hosts models.
One of them looks like he... is, you know, the one on the far left, like it's strange what's going on around his mouth, right?
Looks like an early model, like the same model as the
dead Ford child,
right? The early Ford family hosts.
Yep. And then you got another one next to her, and then you got one looks like some contusion has happened on his head, but clearly Ford was working very hard to recreate Arnold as Bernard, and she is there to assess that in a way. But yeah, there's security around her with their semi-automatic weapons, or their automatic weapons rather, their rifles, their long guns.
And she's looking towards the camera at somebody, and that somebody may be Bernard. Not entirely sure. I'm just sort of gauging by profile and shape of face. But she's making the connection that at this case, that the Bernard that she knows is not human. From that. And then we get a shot of what appears...
It looks like Bernard's back.
Yeah, it appears to be Bernard in the park in modern dress walking amongst the mesas. And then we get a quick shot of a geisha.
A woman in traditional Japanese dress. I don't know if it's geisha dress or if she's preparing for something.
Got a white painted face.
Painted red lips. The incredible updo with the hair piece that is just covered in precious metal.
She seems to be doing a dance, some sort of dance.
Some sort of dance or perhaps opera. It's unclear. And then with all that finery and beauty, we cut to Bernard basically unloading with an automatic, with a machine gun.
Yeah, yeah.
At something.
At something we're not sure, but he's like...
Look on his face when he's doing it.
Right. Bernard, and then... Oh, hang on. I lost my place here. So all that's going on, and then we get... These are super quick shots, by the way. So, and then we get a shot of Tandy Newton, extreme close-up of Tandy Newton's face, and she appears to be in that kimono. In the background appears to be that Japanese, perhaps Shogun world setting. And
is there smoke or something behind her?
Yeah, something's going on behind her.
The medium of air behind her is not normal, but she has a look on her face that says to me, I got this.
Yeah.
Right. Whatever will she wanted to exert is being exerted. She's seeing something happen here.
And then
I get a blackout.
Yeah, then we get a blackout. We hear Bernard's voice saying, you frighten me sometimes, Dolores. And then a slow fade up on Dolores's extreme close-up face. And she has, this is one of my favorite shots in this trailer. She adopts sort of like this creepy...
Creepy smile.
You would say smirk? I would say like this.
This smile. I feel like I want to see teeth in
this
smile.
This
is a smirk that then turns into a smile.
It's an innocent.
It's as if she's working really hard to seem pleasant.
Right. But I feel like it's sort of like she is not aware of how, she's not aware of any sort of, ulterior motive or anything, that this is part of her Dolores programming, you know.
Part of me likes what you have to say there, but part of me also thinks that she is sort of she's fainting, right? I mean, FEI GNT, like, sure. She's lying.
I don't think
why
so.
On earth
I think
would
this
you
is
ever be frightened of me?
To me, this says that, and she's saying, "Why on earth would you ever be frightened of me?" And she's in that blue prairie dress, and in that it what appears to be that same sort of interrogation room, that early interrogation room where she was being interrogated by Arnold. So, I think maybe this is the Dolores programming, unaware of why she would be. Frightening to Arnold or Bernard or whoever she's talking to. Then you get the sort of this high-pitched electronic hiss over the Westworld logo, season 2. And that's the end of the trailer. Yeah, and then we see just a sort of a slow-motion shot of that same shot of Maeve walking through Shogun World.
21 days from the recording of this episode, we're going to see that second season of Westworld. We have waited for a very long time. But Andy, you didn't have to wait for a very long time. I want to get into that. But before that, I just want to know your overall impressions of this official trailer. Right? We got a teaser before, but now, I mean, we've spent an hour talking about this this 2 minutes and 40 seconds, right? Which you can just imagine how long it took them to make this trailer, right? To get it perfect.
I think we spent almost as much time talking about this trailer as it took for them to make it.
So yeah, but what do you what are you feeling about what you saw during this trailer?
There are parts of this trailer, the stuff that is completely foreign to what we've seen in season one, that I am super excited about and super thrilled to see roll out, how all of that plays out. And then there are other parts which to me clearly seem to be the immediate aftermath of the VIP gala massacre. And so I feel like these clips come from mostly from episode one, I'm going to guess, episode one of season two, and maybe some from episodes two and three. I know from the way that they usually cut trailers, when they do release them, they usually cut based on the footage that they have. And at the time that they were cutting this trailer, they probably just had, and again, they probably would not want to use too much of later episodes because it would be too revealing. So my guess is that everything that we've seen in this trailer is still fairly early on in season two, and we're not being spoiled too much of from what we're seeing. But I'm still pretty excited about it. I have to say
that's good insight. Yeah, I did. I like that inside knowledge of from a man who spends his time in this space professionally.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah,
you have to say what?
I have to say that overall, though, I probably was not as excited about seeing this trailer as I was after seeing the trailer for season one, when you knew absolutely nothing about what was going on.
Right. I mean, the thing about season one is that we had, you know, the movie was a thing. The word Westworld meant something to those who knew about the movie, the geeks who knew about that. So the idea of this park and being reimagined, that was exciting. This one, I find that, you know, the first season of the show traveled the entire narrative story almost of the original film, and now they're in new territory, and I have a lot of anxiety about the exploration of that new territory. I think it could be fantastic if it's done in a way that is eye-opening and revealing, and really does get us into this new world, this Shogun world, and shows perhaps the either the awakening of those hosts, or at least the side of the fight that they may have already had if they're already awakened. I like the idea of Maeve being an inter-park character, going from park to park, and trying to do what Maeve does. I also wonder, as much as the hosts seem to have everything under control and the park leaders back on their heels, I can't help but think about which hosts we're going to see, let's call it, retired this season. You know what I mean? Because the Empire always strikes back. I just don't know. And, you know, when I'm watching the original, the first season, having seen the original Westworld, I have a loose idea of what's going to happen. It's all about how they do it, not the shock of what they do. But with season two, the anxiety comes because I don't know what will happen at all. And in this age of reboots and remakes and adaptations, I'm not used to new plot. I'm just not. So I'm kind of excited to see where this goes. I do like the growth of Dolores. This seems to be a much more Dolores-heavy season
from what
we've seen right here.
Yeah.
I'm happy with that. I'm okay with that. I think HBO itself has kind of done this interesting thing, and you've mentioned this to me.
Yeah.
You mentioned it to me with The Deuce, and I think this does work as a theme across HBO's modern stuff, where you've got these put down female characters in the beginning of a show, and whether it's Game of Thrones or Westworld, by a certain point, they are fed up with that shit.
Yeah.
And they're going to take the world back. And if that's where this is going, I think it's going to be really, really interesting to watch, because this is a different way of looking at the AI taking over than you see with like Skynet, or that you see with with you know, the movie AI by Spielberg and Kubrick.
Sure.
This is a very visceral layout. So I'm excited about this now. But Andy, you've actually had more contact with Westworld. You were at South by Southwest. There was not just some stuff that touched on Westworld, but there was some official Westworld content over at South by Southwest. And I can't wait to hear what you experienced and how it ties into all this.
Yeah, so, and we will definitely get into that, but let's take a little break first. All right, so let's talk about some other stuff briefly here before we're running a little long on this episode, obviously, but we
have a lot of pent-up Westworld love.
Yes.
That hasn't been able to be discussed in several weeks online, so that's part of it, yeah.
So we're going to talk about this briefly and then wrap it up. As we're recording this episode, I'm throwing you a curveball, Dwayne, because you don't know what I'm about to talk about.
Uh-oh. As long as it doesn't involve bunnies, I'm cool, man.
As we're recording this episode, on April 1st, which is traditionally April Fool's Day.
It's just Easter to me, man.
As anyone who has lived online knows that on April Fool's Day, you get sometimes April Fools on the web. Well, Westworld, the people at Westworld are no exception to that tradition. And as we speak, I'm sure by the time that you listen to this and log on, you will find that this is probably all gone. But currently, as we record this, if you go to delosdestinations.com /#experience, our pound experience, and Dwayne, if you can follow along with me, it is the part of the Delos website where they talk about the different Delos parks, right? And we've already seen Westworld uncovered as park number one, right? And the other one has sort of this, had traditionally sort of this fuzzed out, what looked like a Japanese setting. And it said, park number two coming. We didn't actually know what the title of that park was. Well, now it's clearly Shogun World. I don't know that I can trust it, though, because if you look at some of the other parks, all of the parks are now named and labeled. Park number three is Hotlantis. Journey to Plato's fabled nautical paradise, Earth's last great frontier. and yes, all our mer hosts are here for you. They said, get swept into a red tide of mystical adventure and erotic oddities. Park three is Metal World. Become the nightmare child and battle your way through the seven circles of rock and roll with Johnny Blaze, Eddie the Head, and Hell's Angels. Drop tabs with Vicious, eat bats with Ozzy, and axe your way through the Garden of Guns and Roses while she feeds on your serpentine. Because in Metal World, sin isn't tasted, it's snorted. Park five is Shermer High, which film fans will remember is the setting for a lot of John Hughes movies. Whether you want to explore the lives of the Richies, quest for an elusive pair of panties, or simply take a day off, let us put 16 candles back on your birthday cake. The question here isn't what are we going to do, it's what aren't we going to do, which is a quote from Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yeah.
Park six is Hemming World. Careen your ambulance through World War I, pop over to La Belle Epoque to get smashed with F. Scott, steal a urinal on a steamy Havana night. In Hemming World, the bulls will run from you.
If you can make the earth move for Lady Brett, you'll know you found the center of this great American park.
Yes. I love this.
Cream Astoria. I don't know about that.
Park number seven is Cream Astoria. Beeswax, blood, Vaseline, pigeons to pirouette alone upon a blue football field. Testicles complete the cycle. I don't even
Every
know.
Every single one gets more strange than the one before.
I don't even know what that
Triassic
means.
Triassic Park, pending litigation. Right. Like, right. This is, of course, you know, the person who invented the idea of Westworld, Michael Crichton.
Yeah.
That was obviously, Westworld was a park where you could go and this crazy thing would happen, these robots. You know, he also invented Jurassic Park, this park we could go and this crazy thing would happen, genetics, dinosaurs. So Jurassic Park, the idea of pending litigation because, you know, other people own the idea of, like, Jurassic Park. That's a thing. But, I mean, what's your favorite?
I like Hotlantis. Yeah,
I think the discovery for Hotlantis is pretty tight, especially because Westworld itself represents a dystopian society, and Atlantis was supposed to be sort of a utopian society before it all fell apart. But it's great.
So sorry
it's
to say,
a good
but
way to play with this kind of thing.
But by the time you hear this, it'll probably be gone because April 1st will be over. But man, I hope somebody.
I mean, I think if you go to our Facebook page, you will see some screenshots of the descriptions of these worlds. We're going to take some, and it's going to be fun to see.
Okay. That sounds like a plan. All right. So let's talk about some of the other real live experiences leading up to season two that I experienced at Austin South by Southwest this year. Austin South by Southwest had a official Westworld panel. And on the panel was showrunners Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, and stars Evan Rachel Wood, Tandy Newton, James Marsden, and Jeffrey Wright. The panel was hosted by Wired's Jason Tanz, and there was some pretty deep discussion on that panel. They didn't really get into too much of season two because obviously they're trying to sort of avoid spoilers and remain tight-lipped so that season two unrolls for us like a surprise. But they did discuss...
So they can trick us with their editing.
Yes. Yes. So, but some interesting things that came out of that panel was that at one point, Jonathan Nolan was asked if there were some Easter eggs and stuff that the audience had not yet caught in season one. And he said, yes, tons and tons. So, I've heard in subsequent interviews about season two that the actors realized when they were shooting season two that when they are able to see like the big picture, the overall arc of the show based on the two seasons, that apparently there's a lot of stuff even in the very first episode of season one that laid the groundwork for stuff coming up in season two. So apparently it's all there. And that basically by the time we come to the end of season two, we can go back and rewatch first episode of season one and realize all the groundwork that had been laid for season two.
I mean, it makes sense. I think it's smart in this day and age when you've got these surprise based shows to keep the actors in the dark, so to speak. If you write it well enough, you just need to make it so that, they're in the character, you're giving good direction, mm-hmm. and then they get a good surprise as well. And if you've done it right on the writing side and the direction side, there's no spoilage, and you're able to create a comprehensive story that is as tight as it is surprising. That's important.
Yeah. I was really that really gives me a lot of confidence in the writing team on Westworld, that they have so much of this planned out so far in advance that they're able to drop clues and hints even in the first episode of the first season, and that all of it will make sense going forward. That means to me that they're not just sort of making this up as they go along.
Right.
There was some great discussion from Jonathan Nolan about the future of artificial intelligence. He talked about the panel moderator asked, given the AI technologies behind Westworld are becoming more and more real, what advice do you have for creators of these technologies about how they're developed? And Nolan said that unlike the worst case scenario of Westworld, we're headed for a networked artificial stupidity moment where AI is used to algorithmically manipulate social media, that we're currently in that moment now. And we've discussed this on our other tech-based podcast, The Drill Down, where we've seen artificial intelligence used to manipulate social media
or people on social media.
Yeah. And Nolan goes on to say, we've flattered ourselves by thinking that AI would need to be smarter than us to blow us up. And clearly that's not the case. We're about to enter into a very slippery, very complicated moment in which the technologies that up to this point have served us, the power dynamic in that relationship is about to change. So I thought it was pretty prophetic stuff from Nolan, who is creating this fantasy world in which artificial intelligence becomes smarter than us and takes us over that way.
Right. You know, it's, you know, when I look at Westworld, I don't even know that the artificial intelligence is smarter than people.
Yeah.
Humans. It just seems to me that the artificial intelligence is smarter than people gave it credit for. Right.
Yeah.
Unlike when you see, I don't know, Brainiac or Hardak or even HAL, right? These beings that can both communicate with you effectively and can do incredible calculations in their mind. Mm-hmm. It doesn't come across to me that Maeve or Dolores are kind of doing these super ridiculous cerebral things, but mathematical things that we always think about computers being able to do better than us. Instead, their humanity is their edge, right? Maeve is trying to get back to her daughter and she'll do anything to do that, but everyone constantly underestimates her. Dolores is just trying to live her life really, but then she realizes she's just, like, being subject to like rape every day, and so right. When she realizes that she doesn't want to do that, she gets around the barriers that cleverly. She gets around the barriers that have controlled her in the past. So I don't even know that it's that they're smarter than the people who are running the park. I just think that it's a question of these people, whether even Bernard, constantly underestimated by others.
Yeah.
You know, although Bernard is the one that's manipulated the most. I mean, he's led to kill the current head of the park at the time and that kind of thing. But for the most part, no one expects these beings to have any kind of agency.
Yeah.
And when you look at someone like Teddy, you get it, right? But when it comes to the most abused of these people, their agency allows them to move forward in ways that are unexpected. And that unexpectedness, kind of like when you're a kid and you're chasing a bug and then it starts flying and you freak out, right?
Yeah.
You thought it was going to stay on the ground. So I think that it's not about them being smarter. It's just about them not being as dumb. And when I look at the artificial intelligences around that we have today, they're very limited by the human biases that put them together. But in the case of social media, it's allowing people to push their own biases on one another so hardcore that you end up trapped in a closet of your own biases, right? The confirmation bias that we keep on seeing. If you're in the left, you're surrounded by only ideas and stuff on the left. Mm-hmm. If you're in the right, you're surrounded by only ideas and stuff on the right. I mean, if you're on YouTube and you look up something, they keep on pushing you farther and farther and farther down the chain into something that's even more and more extreme. on either side of the aisle you're at, and to the point where it's just, you know, the confirmation bias ends up wrapping you into this polarized corner of our social discourse. So, yeah, I really feel like we're in a strange place, and we're tricking ourselves.
Yeah, Vess, I wonder if some of that that dynamic will incorporate itself into Westworld in season two. We'll have to see. The other little tidbit that I will add from the panel is Jonathan Nolan talked about Lisa Joy, his wife and co-showrunner, her directing her first episode of Westworld in season two, and he was delightfully surprised at how adept she was as a first time director of episode of television.
I feel like you have to say that about your wife.
Yes, but
you know, I'm no expert.
Sure.
I'm just saying.
But he also said that look out for it, that it's extraordinary and it's a bloodbath is what he is his quote. So apparently, Lisa Joy embraced the visceral, violent nature of the show to an extreme. So can't wait to see that. And I'm sure a lot of people are going to want to see that as well. The other thing that happened at South by Southwest is HBO actually put on an experience. What nowadays they call an activation, but a couple years ago we used to call experiences. So at this activation at South by Southwest, HBO recreated the town of Sweetwater in a 2-acre park about 15 minutes outside of Austin. And select people who got themselves on the invite list were able to go to this park and live this 2-hour experience in Sweetwater, and I was actually one of those people, so I'm very grateful for the experience and how this sort of rolled out. I'll briefly sort of summarize the experience because I don't want to. We've spent too much time talking about this, and we've also got the whole experience written up on geeksofdoom.com, which we will link to in our show notes. Mm-hmm. So basically, we all started out this experience meeting at this this bar, this sort of Western frontier themed bar in Austin, that became Mesa Gold for us. They sort of dressed it up as Mesa Gold, which, as you know, is the area in Delos where guests can stay after they're done with their park experience and sort of relax and chill out and drink. And at Mesa Gold, hosts selected a black hat or a white hat for us, depending on how they felt. They made sort of an assessment, like a sorting hat, like a Harry Potter sorting hat experience. And they gave us either a black hat or a white hat. I was given a black hat, so apparently they're reading something from my vibe.
You're a black hat kind of guy, Andy. You didn't know.
You think so? we all had sort of drinks, and we waited for our shuttles to arrive. And our shuttles arrived. Mm-hmm. We boarded a bus, and they drove us out to this theme park, this Western theme park, about 15 miles out of town. We get there, and the first thing we do is we go into this orientation room, much like the one that William goes to in episode 2, where he's greeted by Angela, Tallulah Riley's character, and asked to choose between white hat and black hat, and shown the loadout of weaponry to choose from. So we're in that room, and we walk down this corridor into this door, like the one that leads to the boxcar that takes you into the park, and through that door we actually go into this train car, this well-appointed train car, and I believe it may be the very same train car from the show. Yeah. And there we meet our first interactive host, who tells us to he sort of kicks off this narrative, this narrative that is part of this 2-hour experience. And this host's name is Silent Al, and he tells us to pass a message to the proprietor of the photography studio. And then we walk through the boxcar into the open area of Sweetwater, which is this 2-acre Western park with all of these Western buildings. Inside each of these buildings, it's fully decorated, fully propped out. There were right down to like every little detail. Like the first building that I went to was a general store, and on the counter were these cans of Maiden brand condensed milk, like the kind that Dolores drops out of her satchel. The labels are like fully detailed and everything. It's pretty amazing, actually. And the whole town is populated by, I would say, about 3 or 4 dozen hosts who are...
Is that C. Dolores?
Well, we're getting to that. Let's get to that. Normally, I would say no, but this was actually a really unique experience. So it's populated by all of these hosts, which are these actors who all have these interactive scripts, and you can come up to them and you can talk to them, and they have these spiels that they give.
Loops.
These loops, and they're all sort of interconnected in this in this sort of thematic narrative, and this narrative carries you through this whole experience. So you can go from building to building. Like, one of the buildings I went to was a post office, and at the post office I was told that there was a letter for me. I asked the clerk at the post office if to give me my letter, and she gave me my letter, and it was addressed to me, and inside was this letter that was sort of, it was written from the perspective of someone who was in love with me, apparently, and it sort of creepily got into the area where it was talking about how they will always be watching me, and are watching me throughout my experience in the park. And then it sort of glitches out, like the letter glitches out as if it's losing its programming. I've got like a full host of pictures on the Geeks of Doom article, so you can see, including that letter and including the can labels and everything. But here's an interesting thing about this experience, is that in the middle of this experience, it just so happens that the showrunners and the stars, including Dolores, including Evan Rachel Wood, came to check out this experience themselves. So I was there when the showrunners and the stars happened to come by to check out this experience.
Mm. Did they come in character? Did they come?
No, they came in civvies, in regular dress.
I see.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. I got pictures of that too. Pictures and videos on the Geeks of Doom article, so you can check those out there as well. And so there was a live band that was playing this sort of they were dressed in frontier garb, but they were playing this sort of surreal synthesizer music. There were drinks, there was food, there was jerky. There was this area where it was behind this paneled door that had a combination lock on it, and you unlock the combination lock, and behind there is a secret panel. That behind that panel is a Dulles technician working on one of the drone hosts. So you got to see that. There was a Japanese samurai walking through the park speechlessly. He was like walking around, creeping out guests, getting into their comfort zone, and just sort of walking around. And obviously, he looked really anachronistically out of place, like it did not belong in a Western setting. And the whole thing culminated in this gunfight in the middle of town, where one host killed another host, and then the fallen host was immediately tended to by a Delos technician dressed in frontier garb, much the way Elsie is when she is attending to Dolores in Westworld, and she tells Dolores to, you know, to go into a deep and dreamless slumber. Except at that point, the hosts all turn on this Delos technician, they accuse her of killing this guy, and she starts to panic, and she tells them to freeze all motor functions, and they don't. And then, and then she calls for backup, for emergency evacuation, backup. And then, other Delos hosts come out of the woodwork in technician dress, and they command the hosts to go into an emergency evacuation mode. And at that point, the hosts all turn to us, and thank us for coming to Westworld and direct us towards the exit. And that was the end of that experience.
That's clever. That's a clever way to close it up.
Yeah, you can read all about it.
So 2 hours. You were there for 2 hours?
Mm-hmm.
Did you at all ever feel like, what the hell is going on here? I want to go home.
No,
I was transfixed by the whole entire experience.
I was transfixed. 2 hours was not enough time to take in everything that there was to do. I was sort of overwhelmed by how much there was to explore and do. And unfortunately, like, I did not get to follow the story, the narrative, from all the characters within those 2 hours. I wish I could have, but there was just too much to do. So
I see.
But it was
that sounds pretty intensive. I mean, should we expect any less? right?
Should we expect any less? Exactly.
From the kind of incredible artifice that they've put on for us when it comes to this show.
Yeah. It's the biggest sort of it's the biggest external extra textual experience that HBO has put on in conjunction with Westworld. But
Comic-Con, I mean, they didn't do this for Game of Thrones.
They didn't do this for Game of Thrones. They didn't do this last year at Comic-Con. But Comic-Con is coming up again this year and will be deep in the middle of season two. So who knows? Maybe they've got something equally as big planned for Comic-Con. Who knows?
That's true, yeah.
All right. I think that we have talked plenty, nearly 2 hours on what is ostensibly a trailer. So
Trailer plus. 2 hours for 2 minutes and 40 seconds is a little long, but you know, we had to get our Westworld jeebies out.
Yeah. I can't guarantee that our regular show breakdowns are going to run this long when we get into season two, but who knows?
We try to get those done between 45 minutes and an hour.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Anyway, that'll have to hold you guys over until we talk again when season two rolls in on April 22nd. So until then, stay tuned and check us out next time when you hear from us on Violent Delights. Hopefully we'll have Tosin on board with us as well. He couldn't join us tonight. I'm sorry. But then we'll get into the regular season two. So hang on until then.
Thanks, guys.